Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Hark the Rattle by Joelle Townsley Rogers. We sat in the Purple Lily, Tane Dirk, that far too handsome young man, with me. I drank coffee, Tane Dirk drank liquor, secretly and alone. The night was drenched with sweating summer heat, but I felt cold as ice. Presently, we went up to the palm grove roof, where Beamy Tal was to dance. "Who is this Beamy Tal hammer?" Dirk asked me, drumming his fingers. "A woman." "You're a queer one, Jerry Hammer," said Dirk, narrowing his cold yellow eyes. Still, he drummed his blunt fingers, sharp, tat, tat, tat. Something deep inside me, my liver perhaps, shivered and grew white at hearing that clearing sound. I didn't answer him right away. Slowly, I set up smoke rings to circle the huge stars. We sat in a cave of potted palms close by the dancing floor. Over us lay blue-black night, strange and deep. Yellow as roses were the splotches of stars swimming down the sky. "It shows you've been away from New York, Dirk, if you don't know Beamy Tal. She's made herself more famous as a dancer than ever was Yancita. Some mystery is supposed to hang about her, and these simple children of New York love mysteries." "I've been away 3 years," said Dirk sulkily, his eyes contracting. "That long? It was 3 years ago that Yancita was killed." "Well?" asked Dirk, his fingers drumming droned away. "I thought you might have known her, Dirk." "I?" His wide, thin lips twitched. "Why, Yancita was common to half New York." "But once," I said, "once, it may be assumed she was true to one man only, Tane Dirk." "I'm not interested in women," said Dirk. That was like him. He drank liquor only, secretly, and alone. "I was interested in Yancita, Dirk. We used to talk together." "She talked to you?" repeated Dirk. "Strange how she died. No trace, no one arrested. Yet she'd had her lovers. Sometimes I think, Dirk, we'll find the beast who killed Yancita." Tane Dirk touched my wrist. His blunt fingers were cold and clammy. Incomprehensible that women had loved his hands. Yet they were artist hands, and could mold and chisel, wet clay his hands. "What makes you say that, Hammer?" I looked up at the stars. "It was a beast who killed Yancita, Dirk. Some vile snake with blood as cold as this lemon ice. Those marks of teeth on her upper arm, deep in, bringing blood. What madman killed that girl? Mad, I say." Dirk twisted. He wiped his brown forehead, on which sweat glistened in little beads like scales. "Too hot a night to talk about such things, Hammer. Let's talk of something else. Tell me about this Beamy Tal." "You'll see her soon enough," I said, watching him. "A girl of about your own age. You're not more than 24, are you?" "Born 1st of January, 99. "And famous already?" "Yes," said Tane Dirk. "I guess you've heard of me." "Oh, I've heard lots of you," I said, and saw he didn't like it. "You've heard I'm fast with women, right?" said Dirk, after a pause. "But Yancita?" "Why do you talk of her?" asked Dirk irritably. "I never knew her." "Those marks of teeth on Yancita's arm. Two sharp canines, sharp and hooked. Barely scratching the skin, like fangs of a snake, Dirk." Tane Dirk's hand crept to his lips, which were thin, red, and dry. The light in his eyes darkened from yellow to purple. Softly, his blunt fingers began to drum his lips. Tat, tat, tat. But silent as a snake in grass. "A curious thing about teeth, Dirk. You're a sculptor. Maybe you've observed it. A curious thing that no two are quite alike. We took prints, Dirk, of those marks in the arms of Yancita." Dirk's thin lips opened. His coarsely formed but marvelously sensitive fingers felt the hardness of his teeth. That gesture was sly. At once he knew I'd seen him. He crouched back in his chair, his strong, broad head drawn in between his shoulders. "Who are you?" he hissed. Again the clearing of his fingertips, a dusty drumming. "Why, I'm only Jerry Hammer, a wanderer and a soldier of bad fortune." "Who are you?" "Brother of Stella Hammer, who was known as Jensita, the dancer." Upon the palm grove roof, beneath those gigantic stars, the orchestra began to play a brass and cymbal tune. The air was hot. From far in the pit of streets rose up the noises of the city, loud, discord shot with flames. I trembled. Tane Dirk's fingers drummed. His head commenced to sway. Beamy Tal danced barefoot on the glazed umber tiles of the roof. Her dark red hair was free on her naked shoulders. Stamp, stamp, stamp. Her feet struck flatly on the tiles. Her head was bent back, almost to the level of her waist. Bracelets jangled on her wrist and ankles. "I am the daughter of the morning. I shout. I dance. I laugh away." Shaking her clump of red hair, her strong muscled limbs weaving, laughing at me with all her eyes. How like she looked to a man dead long years before. How like her glances to the glances of Red Roan. On her breast two glittering shields of spangles, about her wrist a kirtle seemingly woven of long strands of marsh grass, rustling, shivering with whispers. The sinews of her trunk and limbs rippled beneath her skin. The head of Tane Dirk swayed sideways slowly. The drumming of his fingers on the table was a reiterative rattle. His eyes, liquid, subtle, dulled with a look near to stupidity, then blazed to golden fire. Thin and wide were his unsmiling lips. His tongue flicked them. "Tat, tat, tat." "She's a beauty," whispered Dirk. His eyes seemed to call Beamy Tal as they had called other women. Mesmerism. What was it? Singing, she pranced toward the den of potted palms where we were sitting. Her skirt rustled like the marshes. Wind of summer. Little searchlights, plain colored lights on Beamy Tal grew darker. Red and violet deepened to brown and green. Still the hot stars above us. In that artificial paper palm grove, with the silky, puffy women and the beefsteak-guzzling men looking stupidly, was born the mystery of the great savannas. Dirk's head nodding, Dirk's thin lips slowly opening, Dirk's golden eyes glimmering, tat, 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 Dirk's steady fingers. The great savannas and the tropic marshes, Beamy Tal dancing, stealthily the music softened from that brass and cymbal tune. It rustled, it crawled, it feared fanged heads. For a little while, I did not see Beamy Tal nor Dirk, but the steamy Everglades, winter noon, grass leaves silvered by sea wind, puddles stirring at the roots of the grass, silence booming like the loud silence of death. Beamy Tal was dancing her snake dance. Dirk's lips quivered. The marsh wind makes a little stir. It is the whispering flute. The marsh waters make a little moan. It is the violin. Where was the soul of Beamy Tal, dwelling that tropic winter so many years ago? On her mother's breast, a little bud of love crooned over with a song of sleep, or meshed in bleeding poinsettia rose, or a soul yet unborn. I close my eyes. The vision does not fade. Florida, the marshlands, winter noon, January 1st day, 1899. Where was lovely Beamy Tal on that stifling day? We saw the fang thing coil, and death struck us there by Okeechobee. Your eyes, Beamy Tal, are the laughing eyes of Red Roan. Now the snake dance, the piccolo screams. Life immortal in your glistening lips, Beamy Tal, in your deep bosom promise of everlasting fecundity. Passion and power of the earth, life is immortal. Your laughing eyes, Beamy Tal, will never dull. Yet I saw Red Roan die. Beneath the shifting lights, Beamy Tal leaped and spun, scarcely treading the floor. Her eyes sparkled at me. She did not see Tane Dark. After stamp, 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 her bare foot struck the tiles, tightening the muscle of her calves. Her bangles rang. I could not keep my eyes from Dirk. His broad, brown and golden head swayed continually. His thin lips worked, and I caught the flash of his teeth. His eyes drowsed and flashed open with sudden flame. Tat, tat, tat. The rattling of his fingers was never still. That swaying head. It was loaded with the wisdom of the serpent that hearkens to the wind, swaying with the marsh grass, winding its golden coils, curving its neck to the sun. Hark the rattle. Red as the sun, two men plow through the marshes. Oh, endless pain, the harsh, wild quivers. A life struggles in the womb. Who will die, and what will die, that this new life may be born? Whimpering agony and an old crone singing a song. All people who sat within the palm grove were hushed, watching beamy towel, fat hands fanning, powdered breasts, silk handkerchiefs, wiping ox necks, sweat beneath armpits, still heat, far away thunder, the stars going by. Music swelled. Beneath its discord sounded a steady drumming rhythm. The arms of beamy towel waved about her head. She shouted for joy of life. The pale eyes of Dirk, basking in mystery, gleamed into fire, blazed up in fury and hate undying. His dry lips opened. I saw his teeth. Through the breast-high grasses surge on the two marching men. Their boots sew in the muck. Softly strums the bass viol. Something waiting in the marshes. Something with golden eyes and swaying head. Hark the rattle. Beware, for death is in the path. Beamy Tal was close to Dirk. Not seeing him, she laughed and waved her jangling arms at me. Dirk's eyes sparkled with madness. His lips were tightly, terribly pursed. Beamy Tal was almost over him. His fingers drummed louder, played the music. Hark, the rattle. Gaily the two men plowed through the bladed grasses. The coiled thing waits, hate within its eyes. They are nearer, nearer. Drums begin to beat. In an avalanche of sound, crashed viol and violin and stammering drum. Dirk's drawn head lunged upward with his shoulders. His lips opened and lifted. Venomous his look, deathly his intensity. Strong and young, fresh from the Cuban wars, Red Roan and I went north, from the Keys through the Everglades of Florida. Through the fens as in God's first day, through the reptile age alive yet and crawling, through strangling vegetation which steams and rots beneath eternal suns, through the everlasting Everglades with their fern and frond and sorrowful hoary cypress, Red Roan and I went north, onward with laughter. What joy lay in our hearts! We sang many songs, fern and flower embracing in fecundity, grasses thick with sap, blossoms wilting at a touch, mire teeming with creeping life, above all, the gay sun. Beneath all the coiling serpent eyes and the opened fangs. Hark the rattle. We sailed lagoons in crazy craft, dreamt on shady shores through sultry noons, shouted to the dead logs and river banks till they took fear and dived and splashed away. We pitched our tents by black waters. We beat brave trails through the fence. I'd like to stay here forever, said Red Roan. By what way I go, with what drinks I drink and what bed I lie down. I remember you who got your prayer, Red Roan. You who are in the swamp grass and swamp water forever. Beating our way slow and heavily at high noon of the New Year's first day in 1899 near Okeechobee in the marshes, came we two on a hidden hut. It was fashioned of the raft of the slow, dead fronds, rotting branches, withered marsh grasses. Its sad gray-green were in the living wilderness like a monument to death. Better the naked swamp, better the clean quickmire for bed. An old crone, moaning within that dreary hut, drowned out the sharp, short gasp of another woman. Red Roan came up singing, slapping his deep chest, swinging his muscular arms, sunlight on his brown face and sunlight in his red hair. At the hut's door, facing us, lounged a man with yellow eyes. Poor white trash. A gun was in his arm's crook. He spat tobacco juice at the earth. There was loathing, murder, venom in his face. Red Roan faltered back from that stare. He stopped short and laughter left him. His brave eyes were troubled by that madman's hate. Yellow eyes staring, eyes of a rattlesnake. An old Indian crone peered up beneath the crooked elbow of the ruffian in the doorway, she who had been dolorously singing. With a scream, she thrust out her skinny old arm, pointing it at Red Roan. "He dies," she screamed. "We want his soul." Another woman, hidden, moaning within the hut, a woman in her travail. New life from the womb, a life must die. I grasped the arm of Red Roan. "Come away," I said. "Come away from these mad witches." In 3 steps, that gray-green hovel was hidden in the cypresses. A dream, it seemed. But we could yet hear the old witch woman singing. Something dragged at our heels, and it was not suction of the muck. Toe to heel, Red Roan paced me, and we sang a song together. A crimson flower, short-stemmed, yellow-hearted, was almost beneath my boot. I stooped. Who will not stoop to pick a crimson wildflower? A rattling like the shaking of peas. A clurring like the drumming of a man's fingertips. Hark, the rattle. A yawning head flashed beneath my hand, striking too low. Heavy as a hard-flung stone, the snake's head struck my ankle. Yawning gullet, white-hooked fangs of the deathly rattlesnake. Out of the crimson flower, that beast of golden brown. Its yellow eyes flickered. Its thin lips were dry. How near I had touched to death. Thank God for those heavy boots, Jerry. With blazing eyes, the snake writhed, coiling for another strike. Its sharp tail pointed upward, vibrated continuously with dusty laughter. Its golden rippling body was thick as my arm. Red Roan swung down its heavy marching stock. Crash! Its leaden end struck that lunging mottled head. Halted in mid-strike, that evil wisdom splattered like an egg. Brain pan ripped wide. The rattler lashed in its last agony, its tremendously muscular tail beating the ground with thumping blows, its yellow eyes still blazing with hate, but closing fast in doom. I tried to say, "Thanks, Red." Some mesmerism in those yellow dying eyes. Shaking with disgust, Red Roan bent above that foul fen watcher, put down his hand to pick up that stricken sin, over whose eyes thin eye membranes already lowered in death. "Don't touch it, Red. Wait till the sun goes down." Hark the rattle. Those opaque eyes shuddered back. Those yellow glances, though in mortal pain, were still furious and glistening. Those horny tail bells clattered. Fangs in that shattered, insensate head yawned, closing in Red Roan's arm above the wrist. I see him. Sweat upon his broad brown forehead, his laughing eyes astounded. His thick, strong body shivering, wind stirring up his dark red hair. Behind them, the brown-green marshes, grasses rippling, a stir going through the depths. His cheeks had never been so red. Before I could move, he unlocked those jaws and hollow fangs. Gripped hard in his arm with mortal rigor, he shivered now from the knees. His face went white. "Cut," he whispered. "I'll sit down." With hunting knife, I slashed his arms, deep driving 4 cross-cuts. He laughed and tried to shout. Howling would have been more pleasant. I sucked those wounds out of which slow blood was spouting from an artery. We panted now, both of us. He leaned heavy on my shoulder. He, the strong. I bound his arm, my own fingers so numb, I fumbled at the work. Sweat on Red Roan's face was cold, and cold his wrist. My arms clung about him. He swayed, almost toppling, clutching at grass stems with fading laughter. I picked up his marching stock and beat that golden, gory thing within the mire. Beat it till its clay-white flesh and bone and skins were one with the murky mire of the swamp. But still its heart ebbed with deep purple pulsing, a smashing blow, and that too died. "It's over." Grimley flung the bloody stave into the swaying grass. "Yes, Jerry," whispered Red Roan. "It's nearly over." I could not believe it. Red Roan, the strong man, the shouter, the singer, the gay-hearted lover. Is death then so much stronger than life? "A woman, Jerry," he whispered. "In Havana, Dolores, she dances." "For God's sake, Red, wake up." "Dances at the Red." "Red Roan, I'm here, boy." Out from the way whence we had come, faintly I heard a cry. Who wept thus for the soul departing? Sang paean for the dead. Was it wind over the stagnant grasses? Frail in the solitude rose that wail again, the whimper of newborn life. In the squatter's hut, the child had found its soul. "Dolores," whispered Red Roan. Beneath that brazen sky, he whispered the name of love, Dolores. past 100 miles of swamp, past 100 miles of sea, did Dolores the Dancer hear him calling her? Dolores. I hope she heard, for he was a good lad, though wild. With a throat strangling in sobs, I ran, and then I sang to Red Roan. His eyes were closed, yet he heard me. Old campaign songs, songs of the march and the bivouac, marchers' tunes. Then he whispered for a lullaby, and last of all for a drinking song. Beamy Tal had danced up to us. Beamy Tal, daughter of Red Roan and of Dolores the Dancer. She laughed and tossed her red dark hair. Her broad nostrils sucked in the hot night wind. I am the daughter of the morning. I shout, I dance, I laugh away. Follow, lover, hear my warnings. I, the laughter, do not stay. Stamp, stamp, stamp. Her body rippled, she cast her eyes at me. Tane Dark's head was rising. His thin, dry red lips open wide. His golden eyes burned with undying hate. Tat, 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 his fingers drummed. In a minute, Cherry, whispered Beamy Tal, not pausing from her dance. Her lovely eyes looked downward, seeing Dirk. She screamed. The music silenced. She struck her arm at him, not knowing what she did. Mad. The man was mad. His jaws were open wide. He bit her arm above the wrist. Before the rush of frantic people had fallen over us, I struck his venomous face. With both fists, blow on blow, blood came from his damned lips. What madness had seized him, I don't know. Likely it was memory surging back through dead life, the venom of the rattler, hate undying. But of that who can say, a strange thing is memory. Yet I knew for sure that to him, the mad sculptor, born in that hut in the hot savannas, had passed the soul of the dying rattlesnake. Hands dragged me back from him. I shouted and tore. He quivered, wounded heavily. His nervous fingers faintly clattered on the table, drumming with dreadful music. Police came in. Look, I shouted to them. Look at those marks of teeth on Beamy Tal's wrist. Two deep fangs. There's the man who killed Yencita the Dancer. The Ghost Guard by Brian Irvine. If every one of the 60 guards and officials at Granite River Prison had been asked for the name of the most popular guard on the force, there would have been 60 answers. Asa Shores. If each of the 1,500 convicts in the prison had been asked which guard was most disliked by the convicts, 1,500 answers would have been the same. Asa Shores. If some curious person had asked of each convict and each guard, who is considered the most desperate, the hardest, the shrewdest criminal in the prison, the answer would have been unanimous, Malcolm Halsey, the lifer. True, it does not seem reasonable that Asa Shores should be liked by every garden official and disliked by every convict. To those not familiar with the duties of prison guards, it would seem that Asa Shores' method of handling the convicts, if disapproved of by 1,500 convicts, would surely be disapproved of by at least one of the 60 guards. But the explanation is simple. Asa Shores' great-great-grandfather had followed the prisons as mariners follow the tides. Then Asa's grandfather took up the work and followed it with an iron hand and an inflexible will, until one day a cellmate knife in the hand of a longtime con entered his back at a point where suspenders crossed, deviating enough to the left to pierce his heart. Came next Asa Shores' father, who went down in attempting to quell the famous Stromberg break of 1895. Asa, therefore, his prison methods impelled, perhaps, by heredity, looked upon every wearer of gray behind the walls as a convict. Nothing more, nothing less. He neither abused or favored any convict. A one-year man was to Asa a convict, and no better than the man who was serving a life sentence. The crime for which any convict was sent up was of little moment to Asa. Neither did he bother about who among the inmates were considered desperate. The fact that a man wore prison gray was sufficient, whether he be a 6-month sneak thief or a 99-year murderer. When Asa shot and killed Richard Mutt Allison, when the latter attempted to escape, the warden had said, There was really no need of killing that half-witted short-termer, Asa. He was doing only a year and was perfectly harmless. A shot in the leg or foot would have been better. And Asa's reply had been, I had no idea who the man was, though I have seen him dozens of times, and I did not know how long he was doing. But I would have made no difference if I had known. He was a convict, sir, and he was attempting to escape. If he was only half-witted, as you say, he should have been in the insane asylum, not in the penitentiary. So that was that. If Asa ever gave a convict a smile, it had never been recorded. It is a known fact that he was never seen to frown upon a convict. He was, in short, the smileless, unyielding personification of duty, and every convict hated him for what he was. When Asa shot, he shot to kill, and he never missed. Four little white crosses on the bleak hillside near the prison proclaimed his flawless marksmanship. Why was this big, sandy-haired, steel-blue-eyed, middle-aged Asa Shores liked by his brother guards? There were many reasons why. It was as if Asa's unnatural, cold, vigilant, unfeeling attitude toward the convicts was offset each day when he came off duty by a healthy, wholesome desire to drop duty as the workhorse sheds an irritating harness. He was the life of the guards' quarters, a big, good-natured, playful fellow who thoroughly enjoyed a practical joke, whether he be the victim of the joke or the instigator. If he had a temper, he had never allowed it to come to the surface. He excelled in all sports in the gymnasium, and somewhere, somehow, he found more funny stories than any other man on the force. The trite old saying that he would give a friend the shirt off his back fitted him like a new kid glove. He gave freely to his friends, and in giving seemed to find real joy. After 12 years' service on the guard line, Asa was still an ordinary wall guard. This would seem discouraging to many, but not so to Asa. It was not generally known that he drew a larger salary than did the other wall guards. He was an excellent wall guard. Hence, he was kept on the wall, while newer men on the force were promoted to better positions. But Asa drew the salary of a shift captain and was therefore content. He did not even seem to mind when he was taken from comfortable Tower No. 1 morning shift and detailed permanently to Tower No. 3 on the graveyard shift at night from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. This change was deemed necessary for several reasons. First, because Asa positively refused to discriminate between short-termers and long-termers, or desperate men and harmless nuts, when using his rifle to stop a break or the attempt of a single convict to escape. The men being locked in their cells at night, Asa, as a night guard, would have little opportunity to practice rifle shooting with a running convict as a target. Another reason for detailing him to Tower No. 3 was because trouble was expected some night at that point in the yard, and with surefire Asa on the job, the officials felt that any attempt of the convicts to escape would be promptly frustrated. One of Asa's wholesome habits when no convicts were near him was singing. It was not singing, really, but Asa thought it was, and he shortened the long, lonesome hours at night on Tower No. 3 with songs. Song, rather, because he knew and sang but one. It was not a later popular song, and as Asa sang it, it sounded like the frogs that croak in the marshes at night. When I die and am buried deep, I'll return at night to take a peep at those who hated me. I'll hast their homes and spoil their sleep. Chill their blood, the skin will creep. Oh, those who hated me. Not a pretty song, nor did it make cheerful those guards who passed near Tower No. 3 while making the night rounds. But Asa loved that song. It was while the walls was being extended another 200 feet to make room within the enclosure for a new cell house that Asa shot the lifer Malcolm Halsey. The end wall, extending from Tower No. 3 to Tower No. 4, had been torn down and the stones moved 200 feet further south to be used on the new wall. A temporary barbed wire fence had been erected about the area in which the convicted worked on the new wall. Extra armed guards were stationed at intervals of 50 feet outside the enclosure to guard the working convicts. Malcolm Halsey had successfully feigned illness one day and was allowed to remain in his cell. Cell house guards had seen him lying in his bunk, only the top of his head showing above the blankets. At lockup time, the cell house guards, making the count, saw a foot protruding from under the blankets in Halsey's bunk and what they believed to be the top of his head showing at the head of the bed. At 10:15 that night, the eagle-eyed Asa Shores, on tower number 3 saw a dark figure slip under the lower wire of the temporary fence and run. Asa fired once and saw the man fall. Then Asa, to comply with the prison rules, yelled, "Halt!" The command, of course, was needless, Halsey having halted abruptly when a 30-30 rifle ball plowed through his shoulder. After the convict had been carried to the hospital, his cell was opened by the curious guards. A cleverly carved wooden foot protruded from under the blankets at the foot of the bed. Several bags of old clothing reposed under the blankets, and a thatch of black horsehair showed at the head of the bed. Before Halsey left the hospital, that new wall was completed. Tower number 4, across from tower number 3, had been torn down and a new tower number 4 built on the new corner of the wall, 200 feet further south. On the other corner, across from new tower number 4, was new tower number 3. Old tower number 3 was left standing until further orders. Asa Shores remained on the grave shift yard on old tower number 3. While off duty one day, Asa, prowling about inside the walls, met Malcolm Halsey. The lifer was still a bit pale and weak from the gunshot wound. "One thing I'd like to have you explain, Mr. Shore," said Halsey. "You pulled me in the shoulder, then yelled, 'Halt!' Why didn't you command me to stop before firing?" "Well, it was this way, Halsey," Asa replied, unsmiling and looking the convict squarely in the eye. "I aimed at the spot where I calculated your heart ought to be, but the light was poor and I had to shoot quick. I naturally supposed you were dead when I commanded you to halt, and believing you dead, I could see no reason for being in a hurry with the command. Sorry I bungled the job that way, but my intentions were good." "But," the scowling lifer persisted, "you haven't told me why you shot before commanding me to halt." "Oh, that," Asa drawled with a deprecatory shrug of his massive shoulders. "That is merely a matter of form with me. I very often, after shooting a convict, yell, 'Halt!' sometime the next day, or week. Besides, if you had a nice chance to bump me off, you wouldn't say, 'Beware, Mr. Shores, I'm about to kill you.'" For a half minute, convict and keeper gazed into each other's eyes. "I get ya," Halsey finally said, "and I guess you're right. I have an idea, though, that my turn comes next, Mr. Shores, and there'll be no preliminary command or argument." "Fair enough, Halsey," Asa replied, as he turned away. At last, the big new cell house was completed. Asa wondered whether he would be left on old tower number 3. It had been decided, he knew, that the old tower would be left on the wall, but perhaps not used. To celebrate the completion of the new building, the warden declared a holiday and issued orders that all the inmates be given the privileges of the yard that day. There was to be wrestling, boxing, foot racing, and other sports. Asa Shore's sleeping quarters was a low-ceilinged room on the ground floor in one of the towers of the old cell house. Ace had been warned a number of times that his room was not a safe place to sleep in the daytime. Convicts in the yard could enter the room at any time during the day without being seen by the yard guards or wall guards. Though the one door to the room was thick and heavy, Asa seldom, if ever, locked it. Asa had risen in the afternoon, complaining to himself about the noise being made by the convicts in the yard. His peevishness vanished, however, after a cold wash, and he sang as he stood looking out at one of the windows and brushing his hair. "When I die and am buried deep, I'll return at night to take a peep at those who hated me. I'll haunt their homes and spoil their sleep. Chill their blood, the skin will creep on those who..." Asa's song ended there, ended in a horrible gurgle. A trusty found him an hour later lying in a pool of blood near the open window. His throat had been cut by a sharp instrument in the hand of a person unknown. Halsey the lifer was questioned, of course, but there was absolutely nothing to indicate that it was he who committed the murder. The guards looked sadly upon all that remained of Asa Shores and said to each other in hushed voices, "It had to come. Asa was too good a convict guard not to be murdered." And though the prison stool pigeons kept their ears and eyes open, though each guard became a detective, the murder of Asa Shores remained a mystery. And old number 3 tower was closed and the doors locked. There was no immediate use for it, and the warden was contemplating the advisability of having another guard's entrance gate cut through the wall under the tower. In this case, of course, the tower would be used again. Night Captain Jesse Dunlop sat alone in the guard's lookout inside the walls at 1 o'clock on the morning following the murder of Asa Shores. Bill Wilton, the night yard guard, was making his round about the building in the yard. Captain Dunlop lazily watched the brass indicators on the report board before him. The indicator for tower number 1 made a half turn to the left, and a small bell on the board rang. The captain lifted the receiver from the telephone at his elbow and received the report. Tower number 1, Anderson on duty, all okay. Dunlop merely grunted a response and replaced the receiver on the hook. Presently, the indicator for tower number 2 turned to the left. The bell tinkled and Dunlop again took the receiver from the hook. Tower number 2, Briggs on duty, all okay, came the report over the wire. Then came new tower number 3. Next, tower number 4. From the 3 outside guard posts came the reports, and one from the cell house, each guard turning in his post number, his name in the usual okay. All the indicators on the board, except that for old tower number 3, were now turned. Captain Dunlop relaxed in his chair, sighed heavily, and lit his pipe. Lazily, his eyes wandered back to the indicator board. The unturned indicator for old tower number 3 held his gaze, and utter sadness gripped him for a moment. Night after night, promptly on the hour, he had seen the indicator for old tower number 3 flip jauntily to the left, and heard the tinkle of the little bell on the board. It had always seemed to him that the indicator for Asa Shore's tower turned with more pep than the other indicators, that the bell had tinkled more cheerily, that good old Asa Shore's report carried a note of cheerfulness that lightened the lonesome watches of the night. Now the old tower was cold, even as poor old Asa was cold. The doors were locked and barred. Never again, thought Dunlop, would he hear Asa Shore's familiar song on the quiet night air. What were the words to that song? When I am dead and buried deep, I'll return at night to take a peep at those who hated. Captain Dunlop suddenly sat erect in his chair. The pipe fell from his lips and clattered on the floor as his lower jaw dropped and his eyes opened wide to stare at the indicator board. For the indicator for old tower number 3 was moving. Moving not with a quick turn to the left, but in a hesitant, jerky way that caused the root of every hair on Captain Dunlop's head to tingle. Never before had the captain seen an indicator behave like that. In fact, the indicator system was designed and constructed in such a way that, being controlled by electric contacts, the various indicators would snap into position when a push button in each lower was pressed by the guard on duty in that tower. In short, an indicator, in accordance with all the rules of electricity as applied to the system, must remain stationary or jerk to the left when the button in the tower was pressed. But here was the indicator for old tower number 3 wavering, trembling to the left, only to fall back repeatedly to a vertical position, then again jerkily, hesitantly to the left, as if a vagrant soul strove to brush it aside the veil that banished it from the living. Captain Dunlop sat rigid and watched the uncanny movements and the bright brass indicator. Vague, fleeting, chaotic thoughts of crossed wires, practical jokers, wandering souls tumbled one after another through his brain. If only the bell would not tinkle. If it did ring, well, death then, though it had taken away what was mortal of Asa Shores, had not conquered his eternal vigilance and strict attention to duty. Further to the left wavered the indicator, hesitatingly uncertain. Then the bell rang. A weak, slow ring it was that sounded strange and unnatural in the deathlike silence of the dimly lighted lookout. Captain Dunlop was a brave man. He had smilingly faced death a dozen times in Granite River Prison, but always his danger was known to be from living, breathing men. Abject terror gripped him now, a nameless terror that seemed to freeze the blood in his veins, contract every muscle and nerve of his body, smother his heart. But even when reasoning struggled for recognition in his mind, what if it were a part of Asa Shores, a part of him that remained on Earth to defy death and carry on? Hasn't Asa always been Captain Dunlop's friend? Why should he fear the spirit of a friend? Dunlop reached forth a trembling hand, took the receiver from the hook, and slowly, reluctantly, placed it to his ear. How he wished, hoped, prayed that no voice would come over the wire. But it did come, preceded by a faint whispering sound. Old Tao. A long pause, then weakly, almost inaudibly, as if the message came from a million miles away. Old Tower Number 3, show. Another pause, a jumble of meaningless words, then a chuckle. God! Asa's familiar chuckle. On duty. Ah-oh. A light laugh, a sharp buzzing sound, a sigh, the faint tinkle of a bell, then silence. Dunlop heard no click of a receiver being replaced on a hook. The line was apparently still open. Still holding the receiver to his ear, the captain moistened his dry lips with the tip of his tongue. His free hand went involuntarily to his forehead in a vague, uncertain gesture and came away damp with perspiration. Must an answer that ghost call? Must he speak to the thing that held the line? When he at last spoke, his voice was husky, a strange voice even to him. Who did it, Asa? Who, if you are dead, if this is you, Asa, tell me, who did it? Again that queer and familiar buzzing sound. Then from Old Tower Number 3, or from beyond, the grave perhaps, came a faint, whispering, uncertain voice. He, it was. The voice ended in a gurgle. Dunlop replaced the receiver on the hook, and as he did so, his eyes rested on the indicator board, and he gasped sharply, for the indicator for Old Tower Number 3 went wavering, trembling, back to a vertical position on the time dial. This unheard-of behavior of the indicator was the deepest mystery of all. The indicators, each controlled independent of the others by push buttons, and each tower constructed mechanically to turn only from right to left. The indicator for Old Tower Number 3 had turned back from left to right. Captain Dunlop made no effort to solve the mystery. Old Tower Number 3 was securely locked and could not be approached except by crossing over the wall from New Tower Number 3 on the southeast corner of the wall, or from Tower Number 2 on the northeast corner of the wall. Dunlop himself had closed and locked the doors and windows of the tower. There was but one key to the tower doors, and that key was in Dunlop's pocket. Unlike the other towers, Old Tower Number 3 could not be entered from the ground outside the wall. It was built solidly of stone from the ground up, and the only entrances were the two doors communicating with the top of the wall on either side of the tower. Besides, strict orders had been given that no one enter the tower unless ordered there by a shift captain, and in the glare of the new lights near the wall, it would be impossible for anyone to cross the wall to the tower without being seen by other wall guards. Could the mysterious report have come from one of the other wall towers? Impossible for this reason. When the push button in one of the other towers, say that in Old Tower Number 3, was pressed by the man on duty there, the indicator on the board in the captain's lookout turned to the left a quarter turn on the time dial. The small bell on the board rang and all the telephone connections with the other wall towers were automatically cut off until the captain had replaced the telephone receiver on the hook after receiving the report from Old Tower Number 3. Dunlop said nothing to Bill Wilton when the latter returned to the yard lookout after making his round in the yard. It would be best, he reasoned, to say nothing to anybody about the mysterious call. They would only laugh at him if he told them about it. If the indicator had not returned to a vertical position on the time dial, he would have some proof in which to base his wild story of the ghost call. But the indicator had before his own eyes returned to its former position after the call. An hour later at 2 a.m., Dunlop fearfully watched the indicator for Old Tower Number 3. Reports from all other posts had been received. Then just once the indicator trembled uncertainly, made almost a quarter turn to the left and snapped back to a vertical position. At 3 o'clock it did not move, nor did it move at 4 o'clock. A week passed. Not a tremor disturbed the ghost tower indicator. Then, one morning at 1:30 o'clock, an unearthly piercing scream in the cell house awaked half the men in the building and sent the cell house guard scurrying down to the cell 21 on the corridor, for it was from this cell that the blood-chilling scream had come. The bloodless, perspiration-dampened face of Malcolm Halsey, the lifer, was pressed against the bars of the cell door when the guards arrived. The convict's great hands grasped the bars, and his 250-pound bulk, clad in only a regulation undershirt, twitched, started, and trembled from head to foot. A horrible fear distended his eyes. His teeth clicked together and the muscles of his face worked spasmodically. "Sick, Halsey?" the guard demanded, hardened to such nerve-shattering outburst in a building full of tortured souls. I saw, Halsey began, his teeth chattering and rendering speech well-nigh impossible. "I saw. Oh, Mr. Hill, please, give me a cellmate. Now, tonight. I'm a sick man, Mr. Hill. Nerves all shot to pieces, I guess. Can't I have a cellmate to talk to, Mr. Hill?" "What did you see?" the guard asked. "He was standing right where you are now," Halsey whispered hoarsely. "Pointing his finger at me, he was, when I opened my eyes and saw him. Smiling, too, I... A violent shudder. I could see through him, Mr. Hill. Could see the bars on that window beyond him. I..." "Who? See who?" the guard interrupted. Halsey seemed to realize then that he was talking too much, that he was not conducting himself as the hardest convict in the prison should. "Why," he stammered, "I saw it. I thought I saw an old pal of mine. He's been dead a long time. Nerves, I guess. Thinking too much about my old pal in the good old days. Nightmare, I guess." "Yeah, nightmare is right," the unsympathetic guard growled. "But don't let another blot like that out of you, or we'll throw you in a padded cell. Got the whole wing stirred up. Get to bed now and forget the good old pal of yours." "If I only could," Halsey whispered huskily to himself as he got back into the bunk. 2 weeks passed. There were no more outbursts from cell 21. The ghost tower on the wall was silent cold. Then at 2 o'clock one morning, Captain Dunlop saw the indicator move. It sickened him, made him wish ardently that he was 1,000 miles from Granite River Prison. The indicator moved slowly, hesitantly to the left, and the bell tinkled weakly. The captain placed the receiver to his ear, but no sound came. The line was dead. The indicator fell back to its original position as the captain replaced the receiver on the crotch. A few minutes later, the yard guard entered the lookout. Bill Walton, the regular yard guard on the graveyard shift, was away on leave, and the substitute guard was new at the prison. "Didn't I understand you to say, Mr. Dunlop," the new guard said, "that there was no one on old tower number 3? "You sure did," Dunlop answered. The guard pulled his left ear and looked puzzled. "Funny," he finally remarked. "Was sure I heard somebody in that tower singing soft and low-like when I passed under it a few minutes ago." "What was he singing?" the captain asked, bending forward and fixing a penetrating gaze on the recent arrival at the prison. "Let me see now," said the guard meditatively. "Couldn't make out too much of the song. Something about when I die in the ocean deep. No, that wasn't it. When I die and am buried deep, that's it. Then there was something in it about this dead guy coming back to haunt people and a lot of bunk like that." "I see," said Dunlop, as he eased himself out of the bed. "I'm going up and have a look around in that tower. You stay in here until I return." Dunlop went outside the walls and up through tower number 3, where he questioned guard Jim Humphrey. Humphrey had not seen or heard anything unusual in or about old tower number 3. Captain Dunlop, as he walked over the wall toward the ghost tower, admitted frankly to himself that he was scared stiff. Pausing at the door, he glanced nervously through the window. The yard lights lit up the interior of the tower sufficiently to assure him that no one or thing was inside. He unlocked the door and entered. With a flashlight, he thoroughly examined the telephone. Dust had settled on the instrument. The receiver and the transmitter had apparently not been touched since Asa Shores left the tower. Dust had settled on the doorknobs inside. That the knobs had not been touched since Shores' death was obvious. The one chair, the window sills, the small washstand and wash basin, all were covered with a thin, undisturbed film of fine dust. There on the telephone battery box reposed Asa's old corncob pipe, and near it a small box of matches. The window latches were just as Dunlop had left them when he closed and securely locked the tower a month before. It was a puzzled and nervous prison official that left the tower, relocked the doors, and returned to the inside lookout. Next day, Malcolm Halsey, the lifer, was admitted to the hospital. The doctor's diagnosis was nervous breakdown. But Halsey, though his nerves were all shot to pieces, was still capable of shrewd plotting. His admittance to the hospital had been hastened by a diet of soap. Halsey was so anxious to get far away from Granite River Prison and was so certain of his ability to do so if he could only be admitted to the hospital that he had resorted to the old but effective expedient of soap eating. Soap, taken internally and in small doses, will produce various baffling and apparently serious physiological changes in the body. Holzer looked sick and felt sick, but he was not dangerously ill. For many months, Malcolm Halsey had been watching closely the movements of the night guards. During his stay in the hospital while recovering from the gunshot wound in his shoulder, he had doped out a possible means of escape, and he was on the point of making the attempt when the doctor pronounced him sufficiently recovered to be returned to the cell house. The lifer's plan of escape was simply this. At midnight, while Captain Dunlop and his crew were on duty, the yard guard made his round, counted the patients in the hospital, and left the yard through the guard's gate to eat his lunch in the guard's dining room outside the walls. When the yard guard returned to the inside lookout, he carried with him a hot lunch for Captain Dunlop. In counting the men in the hospital, the yard guard did not as a rule enter the building. He merely turned on the lights in the one large ward and looked through the window. The convict hospital nurse on night duty stood ready, and when the lights were turned on, proceeded from bed to bed and partly uncovered each patient so that the yard guard outside could see and count them. There were several factors in Halsey's favor now, one being that a new substitute guard was on duty over the guard's entrance gate during the absence of the regular guard who was on vacation. There was only one patient in the hospital besides Halsey. The yard guard must be lured into the hospital, overpowered, his uniform stripped from him. Then Halsey, garbed in the uniform, would attempt to deceive the guard at the gate and be given the keys. At 15 minutes to midnight, on Halsey's first day in the hospital, the lifer quietly rose from his bed while the white-clad convict's nurse was churned. 2 minutes later, the unsuspecting nurse had been neatly laid out from a well-directed blow behind the ear, bound with sheets, gagged, stripped of his white suit, and tenderly tucked in the bed recently occupied by Mr. Malcolm Halsey. The other patient, a feeble old convict, was gagged and tied down in his bed with sheets. Halsey then donned the nurse's white uniform, and after arranging the nurse and the old convict in their beds so that they appeared to be sleeping peacefully, the lifer lay face down on the floor and awaited developments. At 12 o'clock, the new guard appeared at the hospital window and switched on the lights. Having counted the men in the hospital every hour since 8 o'clock, the guard intended now to give the patients a hasty glance and proceed to the gate. They were his two patients, apparently sleeping peacefully. But where was the nurse? Halsey's heart pounded like a riveting hammer as he laid sprawled on the floor. Would the ruse work? Would the guard enter the hospital to investigate? Or would he report to Captain Dunlop when he saw the white-clad figure on the floor? The guard's eyes then rested on the man on the floor. "Huh?" he ejaculated. "Funny place for a nurse to be sleeping." But the nurse's sprawled form did not indicate slumber. The guard was puzzled. Perhaps the nurse had fainted or fallen and hurt himself? The guard tapped on the window with a key. No answer. No movement of nurse or patients. Then the unsuspecting screw locked the door and entered. An older guard went reported to the captain. He was in the act of bending over to turn the pseudo-nurse upon his back when his ankles were suddenly seized and his feet perked from under him. The guards had struck an iron bedstead as he fell, thus relieving Halsey of the unpleasant job of beating him into unconsciousness. Several minutes later, the lifer, wearing the guard's uniform, boldly approached the gate. "What's on the menu tonight, Frank?" Halsey casually asked, pulling his hat further down over his eyes. "Same old thing, hash," the gate guard answered as he lowered the key. Through the suspense, anxiety, and uncertainty were terrible. Halsey whistled calmly as he unlocked the first gate. The large bullock on the outside gate was not so easily unlocked. Halsey fumbled, his hands shook, his whistling, in spite of all he could do to keep it up, wheezed, went off key, then died in a discordant wail. "Say," the guard said suddenly, "look up here, by cracky, your actions don't look good to me." Halsey did not look up. He gave the key another frantic twist, and the lock opened. In that short space of time, the wall guard had raced into the lookout and seized a shotgun. As he stepped to the door of the lookout, a dark figure disappeared around the corner of a building 20 feet from the gate. A moment later, the alarm in the guard's quarters rang frantically and a dozen sleepy-eyed men tumbled from their beds, slipped on shoes and trousers, and ran out into the yard. The gate guard could only tell where he last saw the escaping convict. To capture the man on such a dark night seemed hopeless, considering, too, that the fleeing man had a 7-minute start. However, the half-dressed guard scattered and made for a heavy willow thicket several hundred yards beyond the spot where the convict was last seen. For 5 minutes, after the pursuing guards disappeared in the darkness, silence reigned over the prison. Then, from a distant point in the dark thicket, a hair-raising, half-animal, half-human shriek of mortal terror shattered the stillness of the night and echoed and re-echoed about the high prison walls. White-faced guards, temporarily unnerved by that fearful wail, crashed through the brush, their flashlights playing about like the eyes of spending demons. Then they found Malcolm Halsey, the lifer, groveling face down in the mud of a little creek bank, hands clutching at empty air, great spasms of maniacal terror passing through his body, the one-time terror of the prison muttered insane, incoherent things. Two guards pulled him to his knees. Others turned half-flashlights on his face, a face such as is seen in horrible nightmares, a ghastly face partly covered with black mud, a face which showed through the grime. The eyes were wide, protruding, glassy. "See? See!" the convict gasped, hoarsely, pointing a mud-smeared hand at a dense black nook in the thicket. "See? He stands there and points at me, and laughs. It's Asa Shores. He's been in my cell every night for weeks, laughing at me. He sang a death song to me, always sang, always laughed. Won't let me sleep. He's coming towards me. Stop him, please." Then another horrible shriek, a shudder, a gasp, and the guards dropped the lifeless form of Malcolm Halsey in the mud. By some queer whim of fate, the speechless guards involuntarily switched off their flashlights. Utter darkness, utter silence enveloped them. Then a faint sound was heard. "Listen," came the hoarse voice of guard Jerry Clark. "Do you hear it?" Very little of it could be heard. It was a faint sound and growing fainter. "When I die and am buried deep, I'll return at night too." Then it was gone, and all was still again.